This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and welcome to A Bit of Culture, a special bit of culture. We've been away for a few weeks because of the COVID-19. And so now, Cam Ruslan, I'm using some technology called Zoom to record an interview. And I thought we'd take the opportunity to, instead of having people just in the studio, cast our net further and go across the seas. So today's guest on a special, shorter version of Bit of Culture, we have all the way from Australia. He is a Malaysian journalist, and he's now living in Australia, but he was actually involved in setting up the newsroom here at BFM. He's also recently edited a book called Rebirth about a general election that some of you may remember recently. His name is Kian Wong. Hello, Kian.
Hi, Cam. No, actually, just very briefly, I think the book, to give it its full title, Rebirth, Reformasi, Resistance and Hope in New Malaysia, still sort of applies, partly because the book, while I think celebrating the factual recounting and reportage of a historic moment in Malaysia's history, actually last section ends with a lot of pieces that peer into the possible near futures. And I think some of it remains salient today, including, you know, we have pieces in there that questioned whether regime change really did happen or not, and so on. So I think, yeah, it's still sort of relevant, partly because, you know, it was not even 2 years ago when all of that happened. And there's no certainty that what currently Malaysia is experiencing now actually will last the way it will, barely 1.5 months in.
Yeah, yeah. And who knows what will happen when this COVID-19 situation is sorted out.
Because Malaysia actually will re-enter the world, if you like, or the region, a much different region, much different world, which all of us, I think, in some, you know, kumbaya sort of way, are a lot more interconnected and perhaps will all either sink or float together.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which then, that might connect with at least one of our topics. Topic number one will be the fatal shore, Australia in the age of COVID-19. And topic number two is going to be reading Charles Dickens in the time of COVID-19. So, Kian, you are in Australia, and you have been reminded of a book called Fatal Shore. What's happening in Australia?
It's an interesting time because if you were to reference this, 30-something-year-old book now? How old is it? Yeah, it came out in the late 80s.
Yeah.
Late 80s, right? 86, I think it came out. By the distinguished longtime Time magazine art critic and former Australian Robert Hughes. He wrote a wonderful magisterial, very gritty in some ways, book about the founding of Australia called The Fatal Shore. And I think, I mean, having read it so many years ago, I had to be sort of partly reminded about it the last few days, partly through some of the ways he framed how the Australian character came to be from a penal colony, and how Australians in many ways are what he would describe as conformist skeptics. That was part of that convict legacy, in which they're very skeptical of authority, which is of course a very celebrated thing in modern Australian culture. And, you know, supposedly very iconoclastic towards authority in many ways, having that larrikin spirit, very laconic, independent-minded.
So what's larrikin spirit?
It's that somewhat sardonic, perhaps bordering on the cynical attitude towards life, towards responsibility and authority, and having a sort of freewheeling frontier-like spirit about exploring the world, and, you know, being in some ways also very generous and believing in what they call mateship, which, you know, has to do with perhaps solidarity with your fellow, you know, hardworking person also scrabbling against the elements. But I suppose the thing is, you know, what that Fatal Shore book, you know, looked at is this, this skepticism about authority on the one hand, but on the other hand, maybe because of the very harsh environment that a lot of these people found themselves in. And perhaps you have an equally harsh environment today because of the type of exigencies and rigors of this neoliberal dog-eat-dog economy that we all live under, that you also have a harsh environment today that encourages a type of conformism that is fueled by fear, I guess. And so that conformist skepticism, you know, seems to have been quite resilient, I guess, from even back then.
I've read the book myself, Fatal Shore, a long time ago. It's really very good book. Robert Hughes was more famous as an art historian and art critic than a historian. Yeah. But he really, as you say, it's gripping and gritty, and I certainly took it on board as being the definition of the creation myth of Australia, and that the stories in that were carried through. But I've been to Australia since then, and I've had conversations with Australians, and a couple of things have sort of stood out as perhaps contradicting the notion that the penal colony experience is embedded in the DNA. And one is that I was speaking to one woman. She was saying that one of the dirty secrets of Australia is that, yes, there was the penal colony, and there is that sense of mateship where the different convicts had to work together to survive. But for all the convicts, there were also jailers.
Yeah,
and they're those lineages are kind of denied because it makes more sense for the Australian myth to be just a nation of convicts as opposed to jailers. And she was also talking about it as being a split, because we were talking about Aussie rules football, that there is a split also in a kind of self-definition of Irish versus Anglo. Self-perception.
The Celts versus the English.
Yeah, yeah. So something like Aussie Rules, which actually is a Gaelic game, is actually from Ireland, is watched by self-identifying Celtic mindset. Whereas other games, I don't know, maybe say rugby union, I'm guessing here, might have more of an Anglo community.
Correct. Indeed. And right up till today, that whole tribalism that, you know, defines the difference between Melbourne and Sydney has partly explained through the different codes of football that they are enthusiastic about. Melbourne being the more rebellious, and from several federal elections since, have proven to be the more leftish, left-wing part of the country, versus the thrusting neoliberal capitalists, Sydney and New South Wales and North region, which are more into rugby union and rugby league.
Mm. And another thing which I had a conversation very recently actually with an Australian person, and we were talking about, I mentioned the penal colony history, and I'm, you know, a well-educated man, I think he's actually a sociologist or something, and it was like he just a bit of a blank, not very interested, and he sort of pointed out that that perhaps these stories would be very true for somewhere like New South Wales, which was a penal state, and I'm going to guess Victoria. I think that may have been a penal state. I don't know, but
they all were, except for South Australia.
Well, yeah, well, he came from South Australia, this fella. And so for him, it was like, well, it's really got nothing to do with me. I don't see it as being part of my creation myth.
Mm, mm.
And then,
in fact,
sorry, come on.
No. Just as an aside, I mean, a lot of South Australians see themselves as being free settlers and make that distinction when it used to be more fashionable to make such distinctions.
And then finally, let's say your wife, Australian, her background is German. Grandfather, wasn't it, arrived in Australia long after all these penal settlers, etc. And there are so many more migrants since then, be they from Yugoslavia, Vietnam, China, Malaysia. Does any of that kind of fatal shore penal colony stuff mean anything to these new people?
I would generally think no, not really. But the way that the society is structured and what is considered a cultural, legal, political consensus that many of these new migrants have to tackle and deal with, you know, would reflect some of that previous, you know, culture of the penal colony, of that conformist skepticism, of the fact that when Robert Hughes was talking about his book way back then, he mentioned how the convicts desperately needed to feel that there was a group lower than they were. And back then it was had to do with, you know, the massacres of the Aboriginal and Indigenous population. Today maybe has to do with the fact that for many years now it's been popular to incarcerate asylum seekers in offshore detention camps, which are not very good, are quite inhumane. And those migrants who can afford to come here by plane are generally much better educated middle-class migrants. And many of them, in poll after poll, have indicated their disdain for what they consider backdoor migration, when in fact many of these people are desperate refugees. So that level of empathy, the fact that, you know, going back to the convict age of how the convicts then wanted, you know, always needed someone to look down on, maybe, you know, survives up till today in Australia in the type of political discourse that goes on. So there is that. But also, I think the other little footnote to all of this is that Australia's unbroken run of over 25 years of economic growth without a recession is going to, you know, fall off a cliff almost certainly this year, along with the whole great global recession that is looming. And has certainly going to show up the fact that for several years now, the Australian economy has been traveling reasonably well, partly because of record rates of immigration. And if you took the immigration factor out, the economy was really flatlining for some time. And that has actually made worse now that you could say the screen has been removed from the backdrop, the immigration screen, that you can see far more clearly how Australians generally are indebted to their eyeballs and are quite vulnerable to any sort of economic downturn.
Well, I'm going to have to wrap this one up in a minute, but can I ask you a question, a personal question? You've got kids who are, you know, half Malaysian, half Australian, German, Australian, whatever, real mixed up kids. Are they growing up to become real kind of Don Bradman, Anzac Cove, mate Australians, or are they something different?
Oh, I think they, depending, they're two very different type of kids, but I think they certainly are well aware of that whole Don Bradman, white Australia mythology, and they would treat it as gingerly as that. I think if there's one thing that strikes me and fills me with a great deal of hope and optimism, is that there's a whole generation of teenagers and even 20-somethings today, even in Malaysia, in the course of, you know, covering G14 up and down the country in Malaysia, is meeting a lot of young people who I think are amazing in their sort of idealism and the way they've been such problem solvers of the sort of problems in front of them. The only real problem, I think, sometimes is that they don't quite have the resources or the way to try and deal with it, that they need a bit of guidance, a bit of sharing of the experiences of what had gone on before them. But I think, you know, that what is represented by this whole swathe of teenagers today, by the Greta Thunbergs of this world, the idealists who, you know, campaign against the climate, campaign against, you know, climate change denialists, and, you know, campaign in the face of the climate emergency, are remarkable. And I think many of these teenagers are trying to do what are very difficult things, which I think in many ways we never had to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah, but you mentioned that they still need us, don't they? Don't they? They need old time.
Yeah, I think they need us to help reassure them, and also in a way to share some experience of how to tackle what can appear to be actually quite difficult, insurmountable problems, which I think even we don't have quite the solutions for. And in so much of it, of course, it has to deal with what the type of politics that we're dealing with, right? I mean, if anything has proven that politics is so essential to weigh, that elections have consequences, that politics matters, it's in the Malaysian example, 2018 and 2020, that politics, you know, good and bad politics, good and bad governance, can change the whole fabric of society and the type of community that we want to live in. And that it really matters that people are somehow interested or engaged in politics, even though we may not like it.
Okay. Well, we wandered away from our theme there about the fatal shore and mateship and all that, but we're restructuring the episode a little bit. So that was a longer first section than we normally have, but in a moment, we're going to come back in part two and do topic number two, which will be reading Charles Dickens in the age of COVID-19 here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, and Kian Wong, who's all the way over in Australia. And now, topic number two is reading Charles Dickens in the age of COVID-19. I, at the beginning of this, well, we're not supposed to call it a lockdown, but it is a lockdown. I didn't want to spend all my time just panicking and looking at social media all the time. And I really wanted to read books. And so I grabbed a whole bunch of books and I was reading them, and nothing really made sense. It just didn't seem relevant. It was like, why am I reading about this when the world is falling apart? And so I saw a copy of Charles Dickens's Oliver Twist, and I picked it up and I started reading that, and I was instantly enthralled because I'd found something which was completely appropriate to this time. And for those who don't know, Oliver Twist is the story that he wrote, I think, in 1835, when Charles Dickens was only 25 years old. It's about an orphan who is in a workhouse, which was a terrible thing back in early Victorian times. And he escapes, and he is on the streets of London, and he falls in with a gang of thieves led by Fagin and the Artful Dodger, and eventually he manages to get his way out of that. It's very gritty. It was made into a wonderful musical and a few very good films as well. And when I was reading it, I realized that, one, the story that Charles Dickens tells, especially in Oliver Twist, but in all his books, actually are living, breathing, relevant stories, not necessarily, though, for Britain, but for vast parts of the world, where the world of those slums, those city slums, are very relevant, living, breathing places today in parts of India, when I was working in Indonesia, in Jakarta, back in the 90s, it would have been very recognizable to Dickens. I think things have changed though in Jakarta. And also one of the things that really struck me was how, not just for the readers of Charles Dickens, but actually for the vast amount of human history, people could suddenly die at any moment. Die from diseases that are never understood. His characters will suddenly die, and he never says what they died from, because no one really knew what these things were, fully understood them. And the cures for those diseases were exactly the same as they really had been in the Middle Ages and in the time of ancient Rome. We would barely recognize medicine. And often the cure was way worse than the disease itself. Charles Dickens's father died. He had bladder stones, which is now a pretty simple operation. But back then, the operation to remove these stones was horrific. They just tunneled into the man's body with nine...
Well, there was no anesthesia.
No anesthesia, no way to stop the bleeding. They tunneled in there, grabbed what they could, sewed it back up as best they could. When Dickens went to visit his father, the operating room was absolutely covered in blood, and the man died a couple of days later. And I just sort of suddenly feel like I understand Charles Dickens better, but also that he is relevant in a way now that so many modern stories are not, in this particular moment, that we're in a time out of time. I don't know about you, Ken. I mean, do you feel that?
I don't know. I mean, if we see Dickens as a sort of part of that continuum of maybe at the outset of the Industrial Revolution that has come to define our age. I mean, we've had our own Industrial Revolution in Malaysia, of course, through the 80s and 90s, the industrialization process, which of course brought in huge numbers of legal and illegal foreign workers. And that has actually fueled our, you know, building boom and all the aftermath and the so-called small and medium enterprises, the SMEs. You know, so we've had our industrialization. And the contest that, in a way, Dickens so amazingly documented was really the European experience of that, which we have since experienced throughout Southeast Asia. And it's also, you know, trying to capture that constant tension that either gets resolved through horrible, you know, mass deaths or pandemics or killings or murders, is, you know, that contest between capitalism and democracy in a sort of what we would call today a neoliberal era of prosperity. I mean, we've had that prosperity. There is huge inequality, of course, that hasn't been addressed in that, you know, neoliberalism. But we still have this contest, as it turns out, in Malaysia in 2020, as recently as a month ago, between, you know, that capitalism and democracy and what democracy means. I mean, people voted for one thing and now they've got something else.
Well, but absolutely. But if we also look back then and compare to now, there's also that the people in Dickens's book who were reading the books were very different from the people who were the subjects of the books. So he wrote about the people who were living in the slums, and then he was portraying that to a readership that could read. And one of the aspects about the people who were living in the slums is they were considered to be barely human. That they had human traits was a constant source of astonishment to people. And they were considered to be essentially diseased. You didn't want to touch them. You didn't want to go near them. You didn't want their disease to break out. And now, right this moment, we have over in Kuala Lumpur, in the Masjid India area, we have razor wires have been put around housing where foreigners have been found to be contaminated with COVID-19. And I think it's just been relented that they will actually be fed. We still have a sense of that the other is dirty and diseased and is a danger to us on a microbiological level.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the thing is, it comes, you know, there is that parallel with Dickens's London or Britain at the time and today in Malaysia, where, you know, or in Indonesia, actually, for instance, right now, where, you know, vast swathes of what really constituted our community and society, these workers who have built our cities, who have run our factories, are not entirely legalized in the type of, you know, government systems that we have been critical part of the economy. But when, you know, things get really bad, they get to go behind razor wire and they get differentiated, and sometimes they don't even get fed, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there are a lot of parallels to that. But then it calls into question the whole idea again of what does society mean in all of this? I mean, is there a distinct difference between what an economy means versus what a society means? And I think that is the question that, you know, several people are now, you know, raising and has always been self-evident, I think, and part of the DNA of that neoliberal prosperity that we have long been celebrating.
Yes, but an economy can prosper if you have a permanent underclass. And in the case of, say, America, it'd be the blacks who for centuries are just a permanent underclass who can always be expected to work for less. And in Britain, throughout the 19th century, throughout their Industrial Revolution, you had the Irish who also went off to Australia, of course. And one aspect about the Irish, I was having a conversation in London with this salt of the earth white woman and East Ender type. And she was saying how, oh, you know, where I grew up, it's all being taken over by them packies and they're not like us, you know, their food smells and they're not like us and something has to be done. I recognized that her name was actually an Irish name, and I pointed out that in the 19th century, it was very common to have signs saying people went, landlords, when they're renting their place, would say, no Irish or dogs. The Irish were demonized. The Irish were portrayed as being essentially barely one step above a monkey. And when I put this to her, she said, well, I don't know nothing about that. You know, memories fade very quickly.
Yeah, or the fact that she has become part of, you know, the society. You know, I mean, there are all these unofficial, you know, stamps on your social passport, I guess, about whether you're part of society or you're not. I mean, there are wonderful, you know, dystopian science fiction films and novels that talk precisely about that, right? About who is part of society and who's not.
Great job back to Australia then. Are you part of Australian society?
I think the good thing about immigrant societies like Australia or the United States, where I used to live, is that anybody can become part of it, partly by inserting yourself in it and being, you know, a big part of it by putting your hand up and participating and helping shape it yourself. But some of it also can be very precarious if those institutions don't recognize these so-called minority efforts to do that. And right now in Australia, of course, as recently as a day or two ago, a dozen prominent Chinese Australians had to issue a public letter, which has been carried in various places, which basically warned about the rising tide of anti-Asian Australian racism and several incidents that have been reported on the TV news, including video footage of Asian Australians being abused on the streets for being bringers of the plague, you know, of the coronavirus. So there is this, tenuousness, precarity, I suppose, about identity here. But I think a lot of it can be, you know, traced back to the fact that the way Australian society, like American society, or like many of the, you know, Western liberal economies, the way they've been organized, have been organized for, you know, just-in-time global production, you know, sequencing, or for producing goods and consumer items which are not rooted or related to the societies that are actually doing the work. And that's why in Australia, for instance, there is now a debate, which is also, I noticed, happening in Germany. It's happening in parts of the US policy wonk circles about, have we outsourced too much of the production of essential goods in our society to a place like China, and now is jeopardized by, you know, when you have these problems of a global pandemic.
Mm. Well, I want to wrap this up, though, but I just want to ask you then a question, which is a question I've been asking myself when I'm reading these books of Dickens. Malaysia. Do you think Malaysia is now, has progressed through the Industrial Revolution phase and we've become used to modernity? We are, in fact, a modern society. Or are we still, in many ways, Dickensian and Victorian and 19th century in our attitudes towards the other, towards the underclasses, toward technology itself? Do you think that Dickens could be read as being alive and well here in Malaysia?
I would think, Dickens would still be relevant to the Malaysian condition. At the same time, I think what makes Malaysia special and problematic is the way race and religion is used to define the society that we have. I mean, some of these issues are tackled, for instance, very soft plug here, in this recent series of updating essays of our book that appears on the University of Melbourne Asia Link website this week. And I think the problem that we have in Malaysia is that we have definitely become, let's face it, on the data grounds, an urban, mostly services and to some extent industrialized society. But at the same time, so many of the cultural markers and the social reassurances that we need in order to function as a society, as opposed to function as an economy, are based on old, you could say, somewhat feudal understandings of how society should work. And maybe some of that is going to not be relevant anymore, or might actually be so mangled in this, you know, recession that we're about to face, that it may not survive, and that new ways of organizing society may need to be, you know, worked out. I think it's great, however, to be optimistic, to end on an optimistic note, and I don't think this is unfounded. I think what has been great is that Malaysia, in many ways, has worked over 20 years of this so-called reformasi period in building up its own civil society community capacity to figure out problems, to work out ways to discuss amongst themselves, to come up with ways to do things. Some of it shows up in things like those bursae rallies. Other things show up in all sorts of NGOs that seriously, 20 years ago, you would not have had, you know? And I think that's a good thing. And it's good that, you know, citizens are taking responsibility for themselves and trying to do something. The bad thing, of course, is that, you know, it's amazing how resilient those tropes of race and religion remain in how we discuss politics.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to move on from that, and we'll move on to the final part of the show. Our timings are very different this time, so we've spoken for a lot longer than usual. The final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest, and Kian's going to go first.
Well, a book that I have not finished yet, but has proven to be quite interesting so far, has been Wolfgang Strieck's book, I hope I pronounce his name correctly, called How Will Capitalism End? I think it came out a year or two ago. And his book is really quite good. It really is, you know, that discussion about the conflict between capitalism and democracy in this neoliberal era. And, you know, looks at issues of how, you know, Brazil has reverted back maybe to some authoritarian future, the dystopia of the United States. But I think it's a great, very powerful book that really looks at these maladies afflicting the world and are very suitable for a time of contemplation now where we're thinking of reorganizing things. In terms of music, I am totally intrigued. Still haven't finished listening to it, but I'm quite thrilled, actually, that there is a new Bob Dylan album out.
Really?
I think, yeah, it's quite interesting.
You've heard it.
Yeah. Or parts of it. I haven't actually got hold of a copy. And I think what's also very good, but of course, those who know this will probably agree, that really sumptuously done German TV series that is available on Netflix in some parts of the world called Babylon Berlin. Now into season 3.
So that's a whole bunch of recommendations that I'm not going to recap. So my recommendation, if your one of yours was the death of capitalism, how capitalism will end?
How capitalism will end? Wolfgang Strieck. Right. Worth looking for.
So I guess my one actually could be subtitled How Capitalism Began, which is it's Oliver Twist. Charles Dickens' is Oliver Twist, and yes. It is his most kind of simple and complete novel. It's not overly long. The plot line is quite clear. I've read some of his, which are magnificent books, but at the same time, I can't really remember what it was about. And as I'm reading it, it's like I'm not really sure what the story is, but it's still absolutely riveting because his characterizations are so magnificent. But with Oliver Twist, the story is very clear, and you can see why filmmakers have been drawn to it over these years. I think if you haven't read Dickens, but you're into fiction nonetheless, you'll just be gripped because he's very funny and he's so amazing at characters.
Absolutely. I think Dickens is good for anyone, any aspiring journalists or bloggers or whatever as well, because he really goes out there and captures effectively real people.
Absolutely. That was his trade at first was as a journalist, and he went out there and then he wrote little essays about the people he met and the things he saw. And then later on, he wrote his novels. And as I say, Oliver Twist, he wrote when he was 25. It's quite amazing.
I know. It's amazing. No. There is a direct lineage, actually, from him, in my mind, to people like Evelyn Waugh, to Joan Didion.
I think that if Dickens was around today, he would be a filmmaker. He would be mentioned in the same breath as Steven Spielberg.
Yes.
He was an entertainer, and I think that he would be in film now.
Yes. Yeah. Except, you know, in this post-COVID-19 age, will there be a film industry?
Oh, okay. Well, ending on that dystopian note, that brings us to the end of this week's technology-assisted episode of A Bit of Culture. I'm going to try and fine-tune the technology and maybe we get more people and work things out. But for now, I really want to thank all the way from Australia, Kian Wong.
Thank you, Cam. It's been good.
And from myself, Cam Ruslan. Well, that's it for this week. And we're going to do another one for next week. And please join us for that on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.